Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another episode where today we're going to be discussing Marxism, thusly called after its founder, Karl Marx. And today, inshallah, we're going to be, because Marxism is a huge thing. It's had a massive impact on the 20th century in particular, 19th and 20th century, in politics and geopolitics and history. And so we've decided to make a two-part session. The first bit, we're going to be just focusing on three different aspects of Marxism. We're going to be discussing briefly what is referred to as historical materialism, and we're going to be discussing class struggle, what Marx understood by it, and finally we're going to be discussing surplus value, which is an important economic understanding that Marx had, or a proposition that he had, you could say. After that, we're going to be discussing very briefly as well some criticisms of Marxism and a general understanding of what Islam would say in opposition to Marx. This is the brief outline today. There's things that are conspicuously missing from that list, which are very important in the kind of history of Marx, not only theory but practice and implementation. Theory of alienation, for example, being a very key one. We're not going to delve into any considerable details like the works of Engel, who also obviously helped Karl Marx, or Hegelian dialectical theory, which is very important to Marx, to understanding Marx. These kinds of things may be discussed in the second session. We'll see if we have a place for it. But in this particular session, we're going to be looking at these three things of the theory. So we'll start off with Karl Marx himself, a man who is one of the greatest geniuses that, you know, the West has produced in terms of his background. He done a philosophy, I believe, a doctorate, but he was also an economist. And he died here in London. I think he's buried in North London somewhere, and there's a big picture of, or a statue of his head. You can, I don't know which cemetery, somewhere in North London. Where? Is a Highgate, right? And you can see like a big kind of statue of his head and stuff like that. But because he spent the last part of his life here in London. And so Karl Marx, we can see here in the first slide, he was a philosopher, social scientist, and a historian. You can put into that list as well an economist, because he clearly understood economics, or at least it can be argued that he understood it. He definitely understood economics, but his theories of it are heavily controversial. And some of his books include, well, these are just two that I've put out, The Communist Manifesto and The Class Struggles in France. But there are obviously other ones, like The German Ideology. I mean, he's written lots of books, as I've mentioned before, with Engels. And some of these books are bigger than others. Some of them are accessible, some of them are not accessible. But it's worth looking at what the man has to say himself, because a lot of how we access Marx nowadays is through the prism of neoliberal kind of Western understandings of Marx, or some criticism of him. But we have to try and make an effort, like every other ideology that we've actually covered here, to understand what he is trying to say in the first place, because you'll find that his criticism of capitalism in particular was particularly scathing. Yeah, he did have insights which had an impact in his time and beyond. So he died in London, as we mentioned. So historical materialism, the first thing, is really what the theory is based on. Now, historical materialism is juxtaposed, if you like, contrasted with that which is referred to as idealism. And the basic idea is that there are material forces that are interacting with each other in an economy, for example. And remember when we done materialism in epistemology, it's the name is this kind of same thing. We talked about naturalism and materialism. In materialism, they don't believe in any, or materialists don't believe in any supernatural forces, etc. So someone who's in a historical materialist like Marx would say that we don't use abstract ideas, for example, or supernatural ideas or whatever it may be, in order to explain the functioning of society. This is what's understood as historical materialism. Okay, so how do we understand the base and the superstructure? We understand it materially. Things are happening, movement, material. And in fact, part of what he says, and this is interesting because it's quite Aristotelian in many ways. He says that there's always change. The only thing that is constant is change itself, in fact. And this, the change that's happening is material change in an economy. And this is how we understand everything. Obviously, now, just on a side note, it's important to note that there's contentions about, okay, if it's materialistic things which bring about things which are kind of the superstructure, what influences what? Is there a symbiotic relationship? Is it asymmetrical? Is it symmetrical? And there's whole discussions about this. But the point is, in a nutshell, he says, supernatural forces, ideas, and abstract things do not influence how things go in a society. Everything is down to its material basics. And another thing which is very, very important in Marx is labor, the human labor. Okay, and this is really what comes out in the political discourse. Labor rights, trade union rights, really a lot of it comes back to Marx. A lot of it comes back to labor rights, come back to Marx. Why? The idea of exploitation, which another thing is not, I haven't put like a whole slide for it, but the idea or Marx's idea of exploitation is huge. But labor is something which is tangible, is material, and is objective for Marx. It's not something which is abstract or something like this. And so we'll come to this point and how Marx sees labor is very central to his theory. And he also has this kind of, he has predictions. One of the criticisms, as we're going to see, of Marx is the fact that sometimes his predictions don't turn out to be correct at all. But the idea that he sees kind of history moving from a feudal system to a capitalist system to a communist system. And so for example, how does it move from capitalism to communism? Through revolution. Because, as we're going to come to, there's so much oppression based on the exploitation that it's unsustainable and untenable, he says, that workers will live in these conditions for a very long time. So there has to be some kind of revolution, violent revolution sometimes, or maybe not violent, but at least active revolution, a real revolution, which will bring about the change. And this segues us to this very important, you can call it, pillar of his theory, the pillar of class struggle. Okay, so Karl Marx divides kind of human society into two kind of distinct classes. You have what is referred to as the bourgeoisie and what is referred to as the proletariat. Okay, the bourgeoisie are the owners of production. Yeah, they're the ones who have the money. They are the rich ones, let's say. They're the owners of the factory. These are the bourgeoisie. And the proletariat are the workers, the blue collar, the working class. And what he fundamentally sees as going on between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat is that the bourgeoisie, or the rich, if you like, the owners, they are involved in a perpetual exploitation of the proletariat. How are they doing that? Well, because, and we're going to come to this in more detail in the next slide, because of something called surplus value, because of something, because they're working for them and not giving them the share that they deserve. And so there is this tension between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. Now, if you read his books, the question of what's going to happen, is it going to be an ongoing revolution between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, or is there going to eventually be an end somewhere? Is it going to end in some kind of catastrophe or some kind of cataclysmic Armageddon type, you know, catastrophe? And it's ambiguous in the works of Marx. And to be honest, some have even said it's contradictory, because there are two propositions which are independent from one another. But that's subject to your reading of Karl Marx. You know, this, you can look at his works and kind of make your own mind up about that. But I want to spend a little bit of time on surplus value. Surplus value is simply the idea. Okay, in fact, let's read this, what Marx says about surplus value. He says, surplus value is produced by the employment of labor power. Capital buys the labor power and pays the wages for it. By means of his work, the laborer creates new value which does not belong to him, but to the capital. But to the capitalist. He must work a certain time merely in order to reproduce the equivalent value of his wages. But when this equivalent value has been returned, he does not cease work, but continues to do so for some further hours. The new value which he produces during this extra time, and which exceeds in consequence the amount of his wage, constitutes surplus value. Let me just give you an example of what Marx is saying. Okay, Marx. Let's suppose we start up a factory. Yeah, we start up, you know, a factory or some kind of outfit that we have, and we go and get bars of gold. We go and buy some. We get some bars of gold. Yeah. Now we go and get some bars of gold, and we get some guys who are expert at making watches. I don't know, what's the name? Watchmakers? Is that what they're called? Is there any other technical term for them? I don't know. They're experts at making watches, yeah? So we get these gold bars, and we whatever other materials are required for watches, yeah? And we call our outfit, we call it Rolex. I mean, that's what they did, isn't it? They got the gold, they got the, you know, the materials and whatever. Now, we give the workers the gold bars. They do whatever they need to. I don't know how Rolex is made, but I'm sure it involves some kind of, you know, process and, you know, extraction and putting things together. I've seen how it's, stuff are made online. You know, nowadays people are watching this kind of thing as an entertainment. Just as a side note, I saw my three-year-old with an iPad in her hand, just watching some thing being created, and she was like astonished by it. It's just, you know, people are really like, what do they call it? ADSMR or something? I don't know. Or is this something else? I don't know. Oh, is it? I don't know. Anyway, they see these things being created and noises and this kind of thing. People eating food. Anyway, imagine, yeah. Huh?
That's ASMR, like the loud sounds when you're eating.
Yeah. How is that? I have no idea what's going on in the kids' world. You can tell us, brother. Yeah.
It's just kids.
Oh, is it? Do you watch this kind of thing? Yeah, anyway, sometimes they get like a big piece of material and then they make it into something and make like a sword or something. And have you seen this? It's got like hundreds of millions of views or something, you know? But that's what, I mean, you know, Rolex have done. Okay, they've made their watches. Now, the workers that work there, obviously working, they're carving it all up and they're doing the thing. The bar that they got, or that the owner got, compared to the Rolex watch, which has come from the bar, or maybe they made three or four Rolex watches from the bar. Which of them is more valuable? Like the bar, let's say for example, I don't know, 1 kilogram gold bar of and other materials that are required for a Rolex watch versus, so the raw material of a Rolex watch versus the Rolex watch, which is more valuable? The Rolex watch, not your one because it's fake, of course, but it's a phony. I'm only here. But you see the point, it's obviously the Rolex watch, right? Yeah. Now, there's that differential between the product and the Rolex watch. What is that differential?
The labor.
The labor, yeah. Right? Yeah. Now, you've got the labor here, so you got the commodity plus the labor equals the product. But what he's saying is, Even if you do all of that, the worker is going to be given, let's say this worker, call him Bob or something, yeah? How much, let's say he gets, £15 an hour? £20, maybe these guys get more because they're Rolex. Maybe £30 an hour, £50, no problem, yeah? Makes £50 an hour. Whatever he makes, or she makes, yeah? At the end of the day, it's going to be less per hour than would be the case when Rolex sell their watches and get a profit. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a profit, right? And he's saying that the differential there between the price of the commodity plus the labor is the surplus value. And he's saying that's where exploitation happens. Because that's where they should have gotten their money. Now, I want you to think with the person next to you for the next 3 to 4 minutes, what you think the merits and demerits of this are. Go ahead. Okay, the strengths and weaknesses. So what do you think of surplus value?
Well,
What would seem to be the strengths of this theory? I mean, put yourself now in the shoes of someone who agrees with surplus value, or even if you don't agree with it, what do you think the strength of this is?
Having this disagreement between too rich and too poor.
We're not there yet. Yeah, you're talking about communism.
Yeah.
I'm talking about surplus value. I'm talking about, go back to our example of the gold bars turning into watches. And the labor cost, so the gold bar plus the labor cost, still there's a gap between how much this the producer or the owner is getting in profits and how much the laborer is getting in return for his services or her services. And that gap between the labor cost and the profit is the surplus value. What seems to be attractive about this theory?
So the surplus value is kind of good, and someone could argue it's necessary, right? Because like the only reason the factory was, you know, there in the first place is because of the factory workers, and then, you know, if they do gain enough surplus value, enough profit, right, then it means that they can, you know, open up more factories for more workers, or they can, you know, reinvest the surplus
value. You're right, but that's a capitalist thought, right? Marx wouldn't say anything like this. He would say, in fact, that's perpetual exploitation. Remember, what he's saying is, you have these owners, and you have these workers. You have the bourgeoisie, and you have the proletariat. Remember these words, they're important keywords, yeah? Bourgeoisie and the proletariat. So the owners of production, the guy who owns the factory, he gets the commodity. Now, the worker couldn't do this, because the worker didn't have the capital to buy this factory, meaning they didn't have the money for it. So the ones who own the factories are the ones that have the money, the elitists, the aristocracy. So he goes and buys a factory, and now he gets a worker who's mostly, you could argue, in a need for this factory because they need to live. So they get the worker to come in, and they give the worker a stipend, some kind of money that they have to work live on. And then they tell the worker that you have to change these gold bars. I'm being very crude here. Obviously, that's not how Rolex operates. Like, you know, but you guys have to change these gold bars and whatever other thing that you guys have to make Rolex watches into Rolex watches. They do that. The company makes profits. The workers make profits. But the difference between the profits, or gets a stipend, gets a wage, the difference between the profit of the company and the wage of the worker, that differential is referred to as surplus value. That differential is seen as the difference of exploitation. Basically, theft. That you should have given me more, basically. If it was going to be fair, that you should have given... let me put it this way. You get the gold bar for £1. £100. Let's say it's Apple's. Forget about Rolex watches. Let's make it easier, right? let's change the example. How much is an apple nowadays in the shop? Is it 50 pence? 50 pence. Three apples for a pound? Is that what it goes for now?
Four.
About right. All right. So you get three apples for £1. Yep. We get three apples. Okay. We give it to a person. We say, squeeze it, make it nice, whatever, do it. Mix it into nice apple juice. And then he sells it for what? For £2.50. He's squeezing it, making nice, put sugar in there, maybe honey, I don't know what they do, right? And then he sells it for what? £2.50. So he bought it for £1, he squeezed it, whatever, done what he needed to do, and he sold it for £2.50. Let's say he gets 50p for each cup he makes. So £1 plus 50p, how much is the owner going to get? £1. £1, right? So on Marx's analysis, that £1 is theft. That should have gone to who? That should have gone to the worker, because why? That owner didn't do anything. That owner, the owner only put the things together. No, but Marx would say no. It's not the right of the owner, because the only thing that gave that apple, those apples, value, was the guy squeezing it up and making it into apple juice. Otherwise, it would have been worth a pound.
I suppose the owner is also working.
Hmm?
I suppose the owner is also working, maybe not in the same day, but like doing paperwork, maybe.
So okay, no, this is good.
So he's supposed to be also getting paid.
This is a good point. This is not a bad point, because some would argue, well, the owner is also contributing to the workload. Maybe he's got five workers, and maybe he has an oversight function, and that's also labor. But they will say, no problem. I'm just counteracting, right, what they would say. No problem. Give him a wage. Yet, even if you give that person a wage, there'd still be a differential. Let's say that he's got 20 workers. Why should his wage be any more than the other workers that are working there? And if it, and per hour, for example, or whatever it is, and if we do make it the same as everyone else is working there, then whatever the differential is going to be much more disparate. So once again, you have a surplus, which favors what? It favors the owner, because otherwise you wouldn't have a profit. If you didn't have a profit, then you wouldn't have what? A continuous... I mean, you could have a company that works on break-even, right? Works on break-even, but the distribution within that, the breakdown doesn't, it wouldn't be completely equal, he would say. Do you understand the theory here, what's going on?
Yeah.
All right, tell me now, I want you to think about it one more time, because I haven't got any good answers here. Yeah, go ahead.
That the owner, he's facilitating the production, but also like the person who gets the 50p in this example, he's in need of that job. So you could say that like his need for that job is equivalent to that surplus value. He's willing to sacrifice.
Yeah, this is a capitalist argument. But the communists would say this is exactly what exploitation is.
Can you clarify the question then?
Yeah. My question is, what are the strengths? What could be seen as, if you put yourself in the perspective of someone who agrees with this theory, what are the merits of this argument?
They shouldn't be a surplus.
No. What are the merits of the theory of surplus? Let's start with that. What are the merits? What makes sense about it? What seems intelligible about it?
So two things. So the first one is that what you have is that what the assumption, I guess, he's making is that basically you should be paid as much as your labor's worth, which is, like, to most people, they'll say that's pretty fair, right? If what I do is making money, then you should give me what I'm worth. So my labor should be equal to what I'm getting paid. Also, you've got, like, the critique of capitalism, I guess, being driven by profit. Because what that does is it kind of exacerbates the exploitation that's taking place, because the owner has an incentive then to, I guess, make the workers work more hours and decrease their pay, so they're getting exploited ever more. So
mm-hmm.
with that, I guess if you accept Marx's assumptions here, then you've got, like, it makes sense.
So that's a really good point. These are the kinds of arguments, by the way, you'd be more likely to find within socialists. And by the way, socialism, for all intents and purposes, is a different ideology to Marxism and communism. But sometimes it can be used interchangeably. So that's, once again, one of those things you have to be very careful about, because when someone describes themselves as a socialist, they're not necessarily saying they believe in communism. Like in modern vernacular, they're talking about a strong redistributionary system. But what the... So, well, they're not saying that the government should own all, the means of production. Having said that, the kind of thing you just said there is more, I would say, more in line with socialism. I'll tell you why. Because if you say, well, it's the case, and it is the case, that in modern society, profit-maximizing firms, because there's more than one objective for a firm. There's revenue maximization, there's profit maximization, etc. Profit-maximizing firms, they tend to want to reduce their overheads in order to create a bigger profit. Yeah? And so, if the government doesn't set a minimum wage, for example, a living wage, for example, then there's going to be exploitation. And that's a very strong argument. I think most people maybe would agree with this argument to some extent, because you can see, I mean, the exploitation that can happen with it. And that's why you have minimum wages and you have living wages. Otherwise, it can easily disintegrate into slavery, actually. You can give someone 10 pence an hour that has, or whatever it may be. That's an extreme example, but, you know. The point is that Marx sees, even if it was 1 pence, any quantity or value, which is a surplus, would be exploitation. Whether that's expanded or limited is irrelevant here. If it's 1 pence or £1, any of it is exploitation. Right, I'll give you a chance now to think about the weaknesses of this. Let's talk about the strengths. The strengths, first of all, to summarize, is that it's easier to determine that there is a labor cost. Because if there was no labor cost, there'd be no difference between the gold bar and the Rolex watch. Clearly, there is a labor cost. So it has some explanatory scope, because it explains the differential between the raw commodity and the end product. And clearly there is, in the other example that we gave, a difference between the raw apple and the apple juice. So the labor cost is there, and clearly the labor cost has an influence on profits. And clearly the labor cost has an influence, and it's true also that there is a differential between the labor cost and the maximum profits. So there are some aspects of this which are almost undeniable, what he's talking about, almost undeniable. But now what we need to think about is, considering the notion of exploitation, how would you try and refute the idea of surplus value? And is this a all-encompassing theory? Are there things that you think that are missing with the theory of surplus? So two things I want you to think about. Number one is, actually, just think about that. Is this all explaining? And can we therefore say that is exploitation? Yeah. So does surplus value explain all the variables in, say, a market economy? And if so, could we now jump from saying this is the case, go back to David Hume, to this is ought not to be the case, for example, and it's because it's exploitation? So think about that. You've got 3-4 minutes and we'll come back. Okay. Yes. So what are, in your opinion, some of the disadvantages or weaknesses of the theory of surplus value?
Yeah, one, he seems to take into account the value of the laborer, the labor of the laborer, but not the value of the initial capital put into by the bourgeoisie or the start of the factory.
I think he would disagree with that. It's a good point, it's a good try, but I think he would disagree with that, because he would say that the initial capital, are you talking about the initial commodity capital or the overall capital of like the factory and stuff?
Even if you say the overall capital, he seems to assume that the value of that is equal to the value of the labor. But how would you justify that? One could argue that the value of the initial capital is more valuable than...
How are you defining the initial capital? Like, for example, are we talking about just the commodity? Or are we talking about, for example...
All the expenses that goes into the business initially.
They would try and do that. They would actually try and... They would try and put all of that... If they're doing it right, they would try and put all of that initial capital first, and then subtract from that the work of the worker.
But yeah, I don't. Yeah. So the point I'm trying to make is, you could take the exact amount and say this is how much it's valuable, but I think the fact that it is required in the first place makes it more valuable than the exact amount that, like on paper, that the exact amount that is that it is on paper. Does that make sense? Because of one risk, and also the fact that without it there wouldn't be a factory in the first place.
I think you could make an argument like this, but it would be difficult. And there's a stronger argument to be made about surplus value against it. And you're on the right tracks for sure, but you can strengthen your argument. You can strengthen your argument.
What about the labor that goes into getting the raw materials? Do they take that into account? Like getting the apples, who does that? The owner does that.
They probably do take that into account.
Oh, wow.
How about the fact that the theory, like, if we do go along with this theory and we do say, yeah, let the laborer get all of the surplus value, then what could end up happening is that...
He's not suggesting that therefore let the laborer have all the money.
Okay.
He has his own prescriptions, which we'll cover in the next lesson, which is the state should actually own all the means of production and distribute it itself in accordance with equality. Understanding of it, but he's just showing this is the reason why free market economics doesn't work, or capitalist economics doesn't work, because it creates these kinds of exploitations.
Right, but this kind of like term exploitation, it keeps coming up, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like one could say that this isn't necessarily exploitation, because the laborer, like, he has the choice to, you know, be within the contract or not. So
they would dispute that. They would say that he doesn't really have what is a choice when if you don't do it, you'll die.
Okay, maybe another criticism.
You see the point?
Yeah. But then, kind of, I'll say another thing that he's missing in his theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that there are a few elements that are missing. Go things on. Like, what happens if there's more than one person, you know, contributing to the same product? They shouldn't be all getting paid the same amount of work. I mean, amount of money, because they might be doing different qualities of work.
No, right? He wouldn't necessarily say that they should be.
Right.
Say, for example, he's just saying that at the end of it, the owner is going to get the lion's share. He's going to get more than the owner should get.
Yeah, but like, how can you prove that, right? Like, how can you prove that the owner is going to get more than he should get?
They prove it by looking at the price of the commodity, the raw price of the apples in the example that I gave before, the price of the gold that we talked about before, and they look at the profit that is made from the company with that particular thing.
But the owner
doesn't
take all the profit all the time.
The net profits?
Yeah, the surplus value, the owner doesn't take the surplus value all the time.
Right? The net profits?
Yeah.
The owner takes the net profits.
But as in not for himself and for his living all the time.
He can reinvest it if he likes, but that's still his money, right?
Let me understand it. What's the issue with that? Like, what's the issue with him reinvesting?
That's fine. What's the issue with it? That's what you can say. This is fine, but we're still going back to surplus value. What's the issue with it is a different question.
Okay.
Right. Go ahead.
Assuming like he wants to have a factory, yeah, with workers, but we know a boss. Like, the workers work, but there's nobody to like to take all the. So we're not working for someone, but we're working for ourselves. Does that mean?
No, he would remember. His solution to this, and we're gonna come to it. In
no,
the
but
next
like it's a question I'm asking.
Go on.
Like,
what's the question?
So does he mean like that? So he means that in a factory, everything you do is supposed to be that all you do is for yourself, like for each individual. Not for someone.
No, he's saying that the owner should not take it.
Yeah, so...
It's not right for the owner to take the surplus value. So that is exploitation.
I was arguing, does that become a craft?
Say again?
So does that become a craft? So if you have a, you know, my understanding of craft is someone makes chairs at home.
Yes.
And then they sell it. So I would say that would never... They will always do the same. It will never innovate. It will never become something else.
Yeah. That's what we'll come to this. That it does kill you the incentive a little bit if you have.
So if you do innovate, you're gonna have to become either a businessman or like. To
yeah, that's what a capitalist would say. A capitalist would say, really, if you don't want to get exploited, be a businessman.
No. Like, I mean, I'm talking about the craft. Yeah.
Yes.
So if the guy decides to like change his. To create something different or bigger or better,
yes,
and to explore new markets,
mm-hmm.
So it would become he would use workers, so that workers would become it would be the same thing. No?
Yeah, and he doesn't exactly. He'll say this is the problem with the system. That's why you can't have. That's why you have to have a different kind of system.
So you will have a system that's always stuck. Same place.
Yeah, a system which is that the government owns the means of production and it distributes it equally. You'll still have factories, but now the government's going to be paying the workers, not the owner.
So there's no incentive to, there's no motivation to like
to grow, compete
or grow.
Yeah, this is a common criticism of. Right. This is good. This is moving on to criticisms. But we haven't reached this because this is a very common and straightforward. I'm sure everyone knows this criticism. We want to go deeper with Marxism. Yeah.
In terms of when he's judging value of the labor and the capital put in by the owner of the factory, he seems to only be looking at it from a monetary sense instead of looking from like from the sense of how useful it is. For example,
yes.
If you get rid of one laborer, the factory still functions, but if you get rid of the capital of the owner, you wouldn't have a factory in the first place.
I think you're definitely onto something with that. You could make that argument. You'd have to develop it a little bit more. But let me tell you conventionally what kinds of arguments have been made. The relief. Any other points before you do that? Or surplus value?
Surplus value.
We had two things. The first one was quite similar to what the brother was saying, which was to do with the issue of, like, he's trying to calculate how much the labour's worth.
Yes.
So from the owner's standpoint, what he's saying is that, okay, like you may be very good at making watches, but if I don't provide you with the machine for you to be able to make watches, your labour doesn't mean anything.
Yes.
So your labour, the worth, your labour only starts to mean something because I've given you something for it to mean something.
That's right. So you can make this argument. Yeah. You can definitely make this argument. And so the argument that the labour itself, in abstraction, is not worth as much as you think it's worth.
Precisely.
Because the obviously everyone knows, right, in the theory of market, free market economics, what makes something more expensive or less expensive?
Demand and
supply. You might have done this in, I don't know, GCC economics or whatever it is, yeah? You have a graph or a chart, demand and supply chart, yeah? Which is basically these two things, and the price is where demand and supply is. That's a very simplistic model. But the extent to which something is higher in value and lower in value is not just contingent upon the labor plus the commodity. There's other factors. One of them is consumer preference. Consumer preference. For example, right? Let me give you a very simple example. You go back to our two examples, okay? The Apple example and the Rolex example. I get some gold bars and I give it to Rolex and they make it into Rolex watches. A very crude example, yeah? And I get the apples, I give them to Tropicana and they make apple juice, just like they make orange juice. Now, I give the same gold bars and the same apple juice to, I don't know, give me another company that they don't want to throw under the bus. You know. Now, they're all right. They're doing okay. Like Folex. Like a fake Rolex watch, yeah? Folex. So if you guys are workers for Folex versus if you're workers for Rolex, what's the name of the watchmaker again? Horology, yeah? You're a horologist for Rolex versus if you're a horologist for Folex. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Is your labor worth the same?
Under his model, no.
No, under his model? No, forget about his model for now. Yeah. In general, you're doing the same work. You're doing the same work, right? Yeah. So you're working 2-3 hours. 2 out of 4 hours. 5 hours, whatever it is, in Folex versus 4-5 hours in Rolex. At the end of it, they'll put the watch, the Rolex watch, and then the other one has the Folex watch. The guy has worked for the same amount of hours. Or these two guys have worked for the same amount of hours, and they've produced a very similar product. But branding, I mean Rolex, who's going to buy a Folex? Only a fool would buy a Folex, right? So when the fool buys the Folex, it's worth less. So the price of the Folex is going to be much less than the price of what? The Rolex, despite the fact that it's the same commodity and the same labor.
Could you argue, would it matter? Because I think with the Rolex thing, they make them handmade and they're kind of craftsmen, whereas the Folex people could be mass-produced in like inferior quality.
Let's assume that the quality is exactly the same. Okay. I think it's a good point that you said that. Right. Let's assume that the two things, the quality is identical.
Right. Okay.
You got Ralph Lauren and you have, I don't know, a fake one, right? Now, Coke and Pepsi, they're two very similar companies. Yeah.
But in that case, why should the surplus value still go to the initial capitalist?
No, we're not answering that question. Yeah. But what we're saying is, the point being made here, right, is with the Folex company, the commodity is the same, we're assuming, the work is the same, or the labor is the same, but the price is different. And the profit is different, which shows what? That the labor is not the only thing which determines surplus value.
Yeah.
That's what it shows. Because if the surplus value is 30% with Rolex, and it's 80% Rolex, and 20% for Folex, the model would suggest that the labor subtracted is 80%. Full stop, and that's how much the laborer should get. But the truth is, branding has a huge impact, and consumer preference is as important sometimes as we've seen with this example, more important than what? than the labor cost. This, and this is the common kind of recourse or to the surplus value, that it's a fallacy to assume that it's just commodity plus labor equals price, and then you got the surplus value, because you also have branding, you also have the owner might be doing deals with this person and that person, and had it not been that owner, then that wouldn't have been that price. If you know the story of McDonald's, it used to be called the Golden Arches before that, and then in the 50s I think it was that Ray Kroc took over and he made it called McDonald's. McDonald's is something else now because of Ray Kroc. Had it not been Ray Kroc, it wouldn't have been McDonald's. And had it not been McDonald's, whatever, right? And so therefore, branding and consumer preference is a very difficult thing to input, because how are you going to assess that? How are you going to value that? So the market doesn't work in a very straightforward commodity plus labor kind of way. It's much more subjective than that. And for us to assume that it's straightforward and that this is the surplus value is the first issue, not in prescription, but in diagnostic. It is an issue of diagnostic. So this is one of the criticisms of, actually, we've segued into criticism. There is a concept I was thinking maybe putting in, but I can read it out to you today. It's called commodity fetishism, which Karl Marx, it's very, very fascinating concept. I'm going to read something that he says about it, and then I'm going to explain what it is. So he says, the commodity form and the value relation of the products of labor within which it appears have absolutely no connection with physical nature of the commodity and the material relations arising out of this. It is nothing but the definite social relations between men themselves, which assumes here for them the fantastic form of a relation between things. In order, therefore, to find an analogy, we must take flight into the misty realm of religion. There, the product of human brain appear as autonomous figures endowed with a life of their own, which enters into relation both with each other and with the human race. So it is in the world of commodities with the products of men's hands, I call this fetishism, which attaches itself to the products of labor as soon as they are produced as commodities, and is therefore inseparable from the production of commodities. So, production of commodities here, when they are produced, they are seen as valuable because of this combination of factors. We'll go into more detail about what commodity fetishism in the next lecture, but it's an important thing maybe to look up for next time. Now, before I go into the criticisms of Marxism, I want to give you guys two questions that you can write some 500 words for. I'm going to write them in the group. And one of them is about individualism, another one is about nihilism. Okay, so you can put this down, and for next Saturday, if you want to, it's optional, you don't have to do it. 500 words, we can look at it and see what people have written. And I want you guys to actually read it out in class, okay? Okay, so the questions will be for individualism. I'll write it down for you as well in the group. 1 second, I'll just write it down here. Question is, what are the limitations of liberal individualism? Sorry. I'm gonna make this a bit more challenging. Critically assess. Critically assess, yeah? The limitations of liberal individualism, yeah? Say 500 words. And the second one, what has been the effect nihilism in modern society? powdered words. Okay. Now let's go back to our thought we used. So yes, criticism now of Marxism. So we talked about surplus value already, yeah? So the wants of the consumer. We talked about the wants of the consumer. The consumer wants the Rolex watch. The consumer does not want the Folex watch. Okay, so it doesn't adequately assess or factor in the wants of the consumer. We talked about that. It doesn't and it cannot assess subjective individual evaluations. Why would someone pay more for X rather than Y? It's very difficult to economize this, make it into like some kind of figure. So that's another thing. You've mentioned this. It's a reduced incentive. So generally speaking, they say, well, if you don't have competition between different companies, you're not fighting for the hearts of the consumer, then this, in theory, should reduce the efficiency of the product. In theory, it would reduce, because we are, and this is predicated on a kind of conception of human being as a competitive creature. We have the Olympics, we have all these kind of, you know, sports events, and in fact, we have these events there to, and if you didn't have the competitors, you wouldn't have the excellence. That's the idea. And the same thing with companies. If you don't have competition, you don't have excellence. You don't have a reason to go the extra mile. And we'll cover this in the next kind of session, but it's prone to high-level authoritarianism. Stalin's a good example. How is it and why would it be more prone? You could argue, and this is the argument that's usually made, okay, is because obviously the government is controlling the means of production. And that removes a check on it, which is a check on if you have significant companies and people and so on that have money other than the government, and they have resources other than the government, then they can check the government from being tyrannical. Another problem is that it's epistemologically unprovable. Well, at least historical materialism. I mean, how can you prove that? This kind of goes back to our first session with discussions about materialism. And also, you can look at some of the predictions of Marx, which have failed, which you've already kind of alluded to, which suggests that the deterministic, and some people do, well, I mean, some refer to it as deterministic, right? His deterministic conception of movement from feudalism to capitalism to communism has been a great failure. And so some actually take this as, therefore, the whole thing is false. It's very difficult to say, therefore, the whole thing is false, but at least you can say, well, it's a limitation of the theory. Now, Islam is anti-Marxist in the sense that it believes in a free market economy. Right, in a sense that doesn't believe in that all of the means of production should be controlled by the government. And one of the most explicit, there's two things that are very explicit about this in the Islamic stance. One of them is the hadith of the Prophet, where these people were complaining about the prices of goods in the marketplace. And very interestingly, he said that Allah is the Musa'ir. He's the one who sets the prices. Meaning, you know, the famous, pardon? Yeah, the famous quote of Adam Smith, the invisible hand of the economy. Literally, this is what kind of like, you know, leave it because it will set the prices. But having said that, as you know, in Islam, there's very strict prohibitions on setting prices which undermine the market value. وَيْلُ لِلْمُطَفِّفِينَ chapter 83 of the Quran. You know, woe to those who try and go over in terms of the prices or cheat people in terms of the prices. Islam is also very much anti-elitist in terms of كَيْ لَا تَكُونَ دُولَةً بَيْنَ الْأَغْنِيَاءِ مِنْكُمْ, you know, in chapter number 59 of the Quran. So it doesn't become all that money is not circulated among the elites amongst you. It's talking about fey, which is like the kind of war booty or something, but it's a generic statement that money should not be circulated among elites. And obviously we have zakat, and with zakat you have 8 different recipients of zakat, as you know. And this includes slaves, freeing of slaves. It includes al-fuqara wal-masakeen, the people who are poor, the downtrodden, and so on, etc. You know, the people that actually deliver the zakat, the people who are the wayfarer who doesn't have anywhere to go. you know, and the fi sabilillah, you know, money to go to kind of like, you know, expeditions, military expeditions and so on, and also involves some say dawah, some say that actually. So that's why they should be already going to Sapiens page and putting their zakat money. I'm only kidding. But yeah, so there's about eight, there are eight categories mentioned in the Quran. And so therefore, it's clear, and there is a verse in the Quran which says, وَجَعَلْنَا بَعْضَكُمْ لِبَعْضٍ وَجَعَلْنَا بَعْضَكُمْ فَوْقَ بَعْضٍ دَرَجَاتٍ لِيَتَّخِذَ بَعْضُكُمْ بَعْضًا سُخْرِيًا. That we have allowed some of you to be above others, so that some of you can be workers to others, basically. We have allowed this. It's like it anticipates almost the Marxist assessment. And it says, you know, this, we've allowed this, don't worry. The only thing that we are going to stop is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Redistribution has to be this much. It's not a capitalistic society. So Islam is not a capitalist society. It's anti-capitalism, in the sense that, obviously, as you know, riba is haram. It's the idea of interest or usury. In an Islamic society, you wouldn't have a usury-based economy. You would not have boom. And that would, you would anticipate at least that would flatten boom and bust, the peaks and troughs of the economy. It has this redistribution system, but it's also free market. So it's a kind of combination. And we've done this many times already in these courses. But it's a combination of, it has some redistributionary elements and it has some free market elements, and it doesn't agree with either fully, and it's somewhere in the middle. It genuinely is somewhere in the middle, but it's definitely not either. It's definitely not capitalistic and it's definitely not Marxist. It is somewhere in the middle. You know, we believe in redistribution but free market economics. That's basically it. Not socialism, but to be honest, if someone was a socialist Muslim, they could. I would say that it's, the thing is, there's a big discussion about, can you take more than zakat? Can you take more than zakat? Can a government take more than zakat? Zakat's quite a lot. 2.5% of the, not of your income that's coming in, of how much you, like the assets that you have, and that's broken down into, like minerals, and if you look at Kitabu Zakat, there's different types of like minerals. This kind of, like, if you own a petroleum company, 2.5% of that is not, of how much is there. Like, that's not a joke, you know. It will be enough to do what you need to do.
Imagine the Arabs.
Yeah, exactly, right? 2.5% of the actual assets that are remaining, that are not used for business use by the end of the year. Zakatul Mal, plus Zakat al-Fitr, etc. Once that's done, the question is, can you take more than that? Now, some scholars say you can take it for darura, for this, for maslaha, or for some common good. But to take it the extent to which they're taking it in the countries that we have here, like, you know, 40%, 50%, that's very difficult to argue for. Extremely difficult to argue. I'm not saying it's impossible, it's a kufr to believe in that, or disbelief. We'll refer to some scholars and have discussions about whether that's kufr or something. But it's very difficult to argue that someone can take 30-40% of your wages. The government can take 30%, and then put it in place I don't want it to go, like Trident or whatever. Like, it's difficult. But having said that, like, remember, Islamic society is very much pro-caring for people. So the idea of the NHS, or the idea of, like, you know, having caring over the old, the Baytul Mal, like, Umar ibn al-Khattab, he gave money to the pensioners, and there was a pension scheme, and it was also for, it wasn't just for Muslims, as you know, it was for non-Muslims as well, Christians and Jews. And it was a Jewish man who came and asked about it, and he implemented it on the back of his request. So there was a pension system for elderly people, for the people, the weak, the downtrodden, etc. That has to be there. Otherwise, you're going to get people dying in the streets. Otherwise, you're going to get huge inequalities. And that's not the Islamic ideal. The Islamic ideal is not that you have huge inequalities in earnings. Actually, the Islamic ideals is that rich people put their money into, autonomously, put their money into poor people. And there's so much discourse about that in the Quran. But if it's not autonomous, and if it's forced, then it kills the test. It's like, you know, and so therefore there is an aspect of free market economics there within Islam. So that's pretty much the Islamic position. There are some Muslim scholars and hukam and that will go more in, I'm not saying be socialist, but more in the socialist direction, and there will be more that go more in the capitalist direction, but there are some things you can't go too far in that direction. You can certainly not go too far in that direction. There are limits that are set in place by Islam.
So there's no taxes? Other than the 2.5%?
They can be. They can be taxes. But they, once again, they have to be negotiated very carefully. You know, for example, the idea of someone taking my money and putting it into Trident, or the equivalent of Trident, that would be unbelievable. Like, that's unbelievable. Into a war that I don't want to be involved in, or that's so yeah, things like that. There are negotiables and non-negotiables, and we can't be dogmatic about it. But we are saying that there are, on the two sides, the right extreme and the left extreme, Islam is against those two things. That where the government owns all means of production, that would be seen as theft. That'd actually be seen as, like, if I had a house and the government said, "Get out of your house," that would be seen as theft. But on the other hand, the other side of it as well, the free market extreme, where you have usury-based systems and stuff, that would not be there. The city would not look like the way it's looking now, where people are going up and down and bankers are getting this kind of money. And in an Islamic system, that would be impossible. In fact, they would be out of business very quickly.
How do banks work in the Islamic system?
This is a huge question, bro. It's a huge question, and quite frankly, one that I'm still struggling with myself. But if you want to know just straightforwardly what we have in the UK, for example, Ryan Bank and these kinds of things, there are, because they put two contracts in one contract and stuff like that, there's discussions about that, whether that's halal or haram, and that goes back to the Islamic scholars and experts in finance. And with that, we conclude, and in the second session, inshallah, we'll go more into alienation, into maybe commodity fetishism. We'll go into some historical examples of what happened in Marxism, and hopefully that will give us a more full understanding of Marxism, because I feel it is actually a very important ideology, because it's not just abstract. This is something which had an impact on world affairs. With that, I conclude. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.